Hello, and welcome to New Books in Law. This is your host of the New Books in Law channel, Bobby Sharon, an associate in the Environmental Safety and Health Practice Group of Squire Sanders, working out of the firm's Cleveland, Ohio office. Today on the program, we are delighted to have Professor Jay Wexler to discuss his book, The Odd Clauses, Understanding the Constitution Through 10 of Its Most Curious Provisions. Professor Wexler, welcome to the program, and thank you for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
It's our pleasure. Professor Wexler is a professor of law at Boston University, where he teaches the First Amendment, administrative law, and environmental law. Before his appointment at Boston University, Professor Wexler clerked for Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and also served in the Justice Department's increasingly infamous Office of Legal Counsel. Professor Wexler made national headlines in 2005, including a front-page article in the Times, when he published a three-page piece in the Greenbag analyzing the transcripts of Supreme Court oral arguments in order to study the relative comedic chops of the justices. His serious scholarship focuses on the Establishment Clause. Professor Wexler is a prominent member of the legal Twitterati, and you can follow him at SCOTUS Humor, where he provides ongoing coverage of laughter at 1 First Street. Professor Wexler has published several excellent books, and among them is The Odd Clauses. Reviews from the back of the book say it is magical. You'll have so much fun reading about these unsung constitutional provisions that you won't realize until the trip is over how much you've learned. And that's from Pamela Carlin, professor of constitutional law at Stanford Law School. And that's just one of the many highly praiseworthy quotes.
From my friend.
From a friend. See, now we understand how these are made. The physical book is a paperback. It's published by Beacon Press out of Boston. It's got a gorgeous frontispiece on the cover, which it is the scene at the signing of the Constitution of the United States, courtesy of Wikimedia Commons. And wonderfully, the back also contains two tiny animals to capture the theme of the book, which is the Constitutional Zoo, if I have that right.
That's right, but there are animals on the front, too. That's the key. See, people miss the little... You see, if you look at... I don't know if you have it there, right there, but there are a couple little animals in the front in the picture.
I've just now seen them now, and I can confirm that I think that's... Is that a lemur?
I think it's a lemur, and there's a ferret, and some other thing.
Maybe there's a... Oh, I kind of looks like Lemmiwinks from South Park, but I couldn't identify one of them. Well, that's just delightful. And
you know, the original draft of the cover had six animals, but we decided it wasn't subtle enough, so we ditched three of the animals.
Hmm.
But now it might be too subtle because people don't always notice them.
Right, I'm having trouble not seeing them now.
Now
that you mention them, that's great. I did think it was interesting that I thought there were only two, and I thought, you know, I would think there would be more in the zoo. It kind of just seems like the frog and the is that a groundhog on the back? We're just, you know, friends.
It's a wombat.
A wombat. I'm sorry. My zoological. I need to work on my zoological knowledge for the next episode.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the cover. The book is 222 pages, including an index and notes. The typography, I have to say, is quite excellent. Now, did you have anything to do with how nicely it's typeset, or is that Beacon Press?
That's entirely Beacon Press.
They did a wonderful job. It's a joy to read. Well typeset. And so let's talk about the genesis of the book, which helpfully this book actually has its origin story in it, but I'll let you take it away and relate how this book came to be.
Sure. This is when I was at the Office of Legal Counsel that you mentioned before it became infamous. And, you know, it became infamous in the Bush administration with the torture memo that came out of there. But when I worked there, it was long, long before that. And I was working there. And one of the things we did was to kind of comment on constitutional problems and proposed bills. And from time to time, we get some really strange constitutional provisions would pop up, like the titles and nobility clause. So we were dealing with these weird constitutional clauses that you never study in law school and you don't ever talk about in the media, et cetera. And I thought it was great. And I thought, well, someday I'm going to write a book about these weird clauses and let people know about them. But of course, it took 10 years or whatever until I was able to do it. But that, you know, I promised myself I was going to do it, and then I finally got the chance.
And let's talk about the methodology of the book, because one of the great things about this is that there seems to be a formula here, and I don't know if I'm giving it away, but can you talk a little bit about how you've laid out each chapter for each clause?
Yeah, well, the idea was not to just talk about interesting, weird clauses by themselves, but also to link them to some general concept in the Constitution, some function that the Constitution serves, like creating presidential power or promoting equality, something like that. So for each clause, I try to use it as an illustration of that, of the power that I'm talking about. And I also like to, in I think every chapter, at least most of the chapters, try to bring up some modern controversy or theoretical controversy that could happen someday that involves the clause, to show that they are important, even though they're odd.
And the one of the themes that comes through, having attended law school, which I would, this book is especially well recommended for those who have and have not, and especially people who are in law school, and in particular people who are going to take or about to take administrative law. And while I don't even think I found the word administrative law in the book, I might have missed it. But it seemed to be a guiding principle in terms of the subjects that were covered. Am I close to right on that?
Well, I mean, I teach administrative law. I've taught it maybe a dozen times, and I find it really interesting. So it made its way into the book in various ways, since it's something I know about. I'm not sure I thought of it as a major theme or anything. I think it's just my inclination is to talk about administrative law. And I think administrative law and constitutional law are really closely related, particularly in separation of powers and, you know, the creation of the government, which branches have what powers, that sort of thing. So, I mean, administrative law, in a sense, is constitutional law, at least part of it. So I guess that would explain why there's a lot of administrative law in the book. But you're right, you don't want to say the word administrative law, because that just makes students want to go to sleep.
Right, yeah. If you'd have named it the administrative law clauses, I don't think it would have done nearly as well.
Yeah, so it would have sold like 50 copies instead of 70.
Right. Yeah. The additional 20 of the mystery of the odd, probably very important. But also I should add that so the Office of Legal Counsel is closely associated with the executive branch.
Right. Yeah. It's located in the executive branch because it's part of the Justice Department, and it gives constitutional advice to executive branch officers, the Attorney General, the White House Counsel, agency heads, and such.
And do you also get requests from Congress?
Well, only to the extent that bills from Congress get circulated through the executive branch at several points during their consideration. They go, the committees and Congress send the bill to OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, which then distributes the bill across the executive branch. So, no, we don't give advice. Well, back in the day, whoever works at OLC now doesn't give advice directly to Congress. They give comments to Congress about what the executive branch thinks about bills and such.
Now, when you're researching the book, now you said it took about 10 years, but at least for part of the time when you had the concept, you were actually at the Office of Legal Counsel, and there's at least a public library of Office of Legal Counsel opinions, and I like to imagine that there's a non-private, even larger library of opinions. Were you able to, with any of these, were you able to review or look at or rely on actual OLC work product?
Not that I hadn't worked on, no. I didn't call up my old colleagues who happen to still be there, maybe if there were a couple of them, I guess there probably were, and ask them, could I see some old opinion, some that you haven't published yet or something like that. On the other hand, you know, I wrote a couple or drafted a couple that maybe aren't public. And so I drew upon my knowledge that I got from writing those.
Interesting. And the book has a very definite, and your work in general has a very definite writing style that I would say is reader-focused, entertainment-focused, and it seems to assume that I might get bored and walk away at any minute, so that you're going to do everything you can to avoid that. Is that an intentional?
Yeah, it's absolute. Well, you know, when you teach law, you understand that even if you like law, sitting there and listening to somebody lecture about law can be somewhat of a dull experience. So you do want to keep people awake and I mean, that's what you learn from 10 years of teaching or 12 years of teaching is you gotta throw some stuff in there from time to time that people will laugh at. And, you know, it's not just to keep them awake, but, you know, it's to keep me awake also. Otherwise I might fall asleep at the podium.
Right. And so it's replete with pop culture references and other jokes. So it is a delight to read even apart from all of the great arcane trivia and interesting constitutional analysis. So let's turn to some of the odd clauses and hear what you found when you did your research. So the first chapter is the incompatibility clause, and it is slated to discuss the concept of separation of powers.
Right. The incompatibility clause is a great clause that a lot of people don't know about. Maybe very few people know anything about. It's basically the part of the Constitution that says if you're a member of Congress, you can't also be an executive officer. And so, you know, if you look around and you think about it, you've never seen a member of Congress at the same time be like the Secretary of State or the head of EPA or something like that. And you might wonder why that is. And the only reason is that there's this clause in there that the framers put in there to separate powers between the executive and the legislative branch.
And so presumably it's not because the members of the legislative branch are extremely busy reading bills, you're saying?
No, the members of the legislative, they're busy. I mean, I don't know what they do. I don't think they read all the bills. But it's not because we want to keep them busy. It's rather to keep the two branches separate. And they can't be separate if you've got people who are in both branches at the same time.
And you draw from this lessons on the concept of separation of powers, which, I mean, it's a pretty heady topic to start things off.
Well, it's heady, you think? I guess it's heady, but it's really important. And, you know, it's one of those things that everybody learns about kind of in, like, elementary school and then a little bit more in high school. But if you actually say, hey, what does it mean? It's a really hard question. And I think it's worth, you know, telling people a little bit about what it actually means. And so that they know what this grand concept is in practice. And, you know, it's a combination of keeping the powers separate, but also giving branches power to limit what other branches do. So it's a really complicated system and important. So, you know, I want to start off heady. I'm not joking around here.
Yes, and from there, the book turns to the Weights and Measures Clause.
Yeah, that was a subject of great debate between my editor and me. I really wanted to write about the Weights and Measures Clause, and they were really skeptical about it. They thought it was really not illustrative of anything, and it wasn't. I mean, it was even too odd to be discussed in the odd clauses. And I was convinced that the story of the metric system and the United States refusal to ever adopt the metric system, which it could under the Weights and Measures Clause, it's up to Congress to decide whether to adopt the metric system. I thought that story was interesting and important enough to talk about in the whole chapter. And eventually I did prevail. I don't know if I just they just got tired of arguing with me, or they finally agreed with me, or what. But there it is, the Weights and Measures Clause.
And of the legislative powers, it's interesting to choose the Weights and Measures Clause. It's usually when people would think of the Commerce Clause, of course.
Right. Well, if you were writing a book about the really important clauses, you would put the Commerce Clause in there. But if you were writing about the less important clauses, you would go right sort of to the end of the list of powers and find something goofy like this one.
Right. And the question, I mean, that I had, I mean, I just was thinking, if I had homegrown weights and measures, whether or not Congress could forbid that, because I might affect the market for weights and measures by not buying a ruler. Did that come up at all in the research? Have they looked at that?
Did they look at your weird wet measures that you came up with in your garage?
Right. Yes. Oh. Yeah. They're for medical purposes.
Right. No. But it's definitely a uniformity inspired provision, so that you don't have. I mean, I think what they were worried about, not so much individuals, but states coming up with their own measurement systems, and what a pain that would be for commerce. You know, these are the days, of course, when the states were more powerful than the federal government, and so when you're making a federal constitution to consolidate power in the national government, you have to think about what you don't want the states to be able to do anymore, and one of those things is to have, you know, 13 different measuring system. So that's why Congress gets the power to set the weights and measures, to make sure we only have one set for the United States as a whole.
Was it clear whether or not the Weights and Measures Clause includes the measurement of time?
That's a good question. I don't know. I don't know the answer.
I can imagine a state nefariously outlawing the leap second and then causing chaos.
Well, there's that thing in Indiana where they don't follow, part of the state or whatever doesn't follow daylight savings time.
Right.
Maybe that's a violation of the Weights and Measures Clause.
I think we should really work on getting a dormant Weights and Measures Clause.
We
can strike down some of these things.
Clause, I think, yes. I don't know. It could be a law review note for some industrious law student to work on.
That would be well worth reading. Hopefully the green bag will solicit. And then we turn to a clause that I think there's a place where you assert that this is just the most, you know, of course this will never, I can't remember whether you said that it would ever go before the court, but then we turn to the recess appointments clause.
Right. Yes. Which turns out to be at the center of constitutional discourse at the moment. See, when I wrote this chapter a few years ago, the recess appointments clause is the one that gives the president the power to fill up vacancies when the Senate is not around to vote on them, appointments. So when I was researching this, there were maybe like 3 law review articles about the meaning of the clause, and maybe there was one case or something. Now the Supreme Court has just heard a front page kind of case about the recess appointments clause. And what's interesting is now every single legal scholar, you know, constitutional scholar in America, like the most famous people, they've all written an article about the recess appointments clause. So, you know, Tribe's got a piece and Sunstein's probably got 6 pieces already. And Tushnet probably has a couple. So every scholar now cares about the recess appointments clause, but you know, where were they when I was working on this stuff? That's what I want to know.
Well, and hopefully they're gentlemanly about it and are citing you in all of these
publications. No, nobody cites me. Nobody cites my work. It's a sad fact. It's just it's too goofy or something. I don't know.
We haven't seen the Supreme Court opinion in the case, which is they've had the oral argument. So maybe it's still on the way. Right?
I mean, if you know, I think they should. I think it'd be really nice for them to. It would really help my career if one of them would just. Side, even as a, like a C generally or a CF or even but C, I would take a but C. You know,
like, but C being the legal citation equivalent of throwing shade at something. So it's very interesting. Have you listened to the oral argument in the case?
I haven't. I read it. I read the transcript, and it doesn't look like the president's going to win. But I don't think it's that important of a case, because as I mentioned in the book, and I'm picking up on somebody else that wrote about this, and I sort of delivered his message to the 70 people who read the book, which the point is, the Recess Appointments Clause works for all presidents equally, regardless of what party they're in. So if the president's powers ends up limited under the Supreme Court, it's a defeat for Obama for this term, but it's a defeat for whoever the Republican president is next time around. So it's not that important of a case, I don't think, although it's really interesting. Of course, I'm interested to see how it comes out. Here I'll share a little theory that I've come up with about the Recess Appointments Clause recently as I was thinking about the case. What's really weird about the Recess Appointments Clause is that it has a complete, the purpose that originally gave rise to it, it doesn't exist at all anymore. It was put in there so that if the Senate couldn't come back, then the president could make an appointment. But the Senate now these days could always come back. There's not the problem of travel and communications and such. So there's really no need for the Recess Appointments Clause anymore. But so what presidents have been using it for is to circumvent the regular appointments process when that appointments process has become dysfunctional. And so what I like to think of it as constitutional exaptation. An exaptation is the concept from biological evolution, where a behavior or a physical trait once served one purpose and now it serves a different purpose. Like feathers used to keep dinosaurs warm, but then they evolved into being feathers, being bird, helping birds fly. And so the Recess Appointments Clause is like that. There, I've made that. I've explained that. Isn't that interesting?
It is interesting to see somewhat important seeming detritus, and then seeing how the justices react, which you cover in the chapter so well. And I think the predictions are pretty uniform that the NLRB appointments are going to be held to violate the clause. But the real question is what are they going to do about it, right? How do you What's the remedy? How far does this go? I mean, are we undoing?
I think we have to say that Justice Rutherford, or whoever it was that President Washington appointed under the Recess Appointments Clause, maybe was invalid. I don't know. No, I don't know. What will they do? I don't know. I don't think it'll. I mean, see, most of the people who get appointed by the Senate under the Recess Appointments Clause, right? Either their term has run out, or they get confirmed by the full Senate at some point. So there aren't probably that many recess appointees left, right? So what's the question? Whether people have been harmed by agencies that were headed by recess appointees that were invalid, something like that?
Right. I guess if there's some sort of standing order from a recess appointed person, it seems like what they'll do is something akin to, well, you didn't raise it at the time, so too bad. It will be an interesting remedial paragraph or two in the opinion.
Him, I didn't raise my odd clauses defense.
That's why you should always keep a copy of the odd clauses so that you don't waive any of these arguments.
I think that's a good point. I think every law, young lawyer or experienced lawyer really should have a copy. And so after they file their brief in whatever the case is, they should just take a quick look, browse through the odd clauses, see if they missed anything about the, maybe the letters of mark and reprisal clause was a possible issue, that sort of thing. It could be very helpful as a reference for just about everybody.
Right. And now moving to a clause that is just very near and dear to my own heart, the original jurisdiction clause.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You love this thing.
Yes.
You've written about this. Yeah, it's tremendous. It's the clause that allows states to sue each other directly in the Supreme Court itself, without going to any lower court first.
And you use it to discuss the judicial power, the law professor's favorite power of the Constitution.
Right. Some law professor's favorite power, but yeah, it's one of the weird parts of the Constitution. There's not that much about the judicial power in the Constitution, but their few things, and this is the weirdest, I think, and most interesting. So I thought I could use this as a way to illustrate the judicial power, but mostly it was a way to talk about these cases where, you know, Oregon sues Wisconsin, or Vermont sues Maine over some lobster boat which is in its waters that shouldn't be, or something like that. They're great cases. I think the court hasn't heard one in a while, but I think I read something about how they're planning to at some point soon.
Florida has filed a petition or filed for leave to file a bill of complaint against Georgia. That's the one that we haven't heard Georgia's answer.
Like a college football game.
Right. And well, in there, so yeah, let's talk about some of the cases. So before turning to the college football one, do you want to talk about New York and New Jersey?
Well, that's the case that I talk about most in the chapter. It's about whether the Statue of Liberty belonged to New York or New Jersey. And it's maybe the most well-known of these cases that's come up recently. And I won't give away the ending, but it's fascinating. And I think there's a movie in the works with Kevin Costner.
Hopefully it'll be about 4 hours long. With the entire, they'll just have the entire argument before the court. And so in that case, it was fairly clear that the court had jurisdiction. But then comes the this case about college football. And now things get a little less clear, right?
Oh, right. The college football, that's the California versus the West Virginia case. Right. And the court said, you might have to remind me about this. This is so odd. I may have forgotten.
So there's a contract to play a football game between two state universities, and they file in for the original jurisdiction. And the court refuses to take the case.
Right. So the court can refuse to take one of these cases if it feels like it's not big enough of a deal, kind of. And then Steven says, no, we should take all the cases that are like this. And I think he's right. Not only should they take them, but they should have a trial right in front of the Supreme Court itself, with all the judges holding a gavel and making rulings on evidence. It would be a spectacle. It would be great.
I mean, especially if Ohio State could sue Michigan. I mean,
oof. Yeah. Nope.
I mean, the cases here are just great. I think my favorite quote is that one of the compilers said that they run right like threads of gold through the reports.
I did not know that. That's great.
Which I think is partially a reference to the fact that they're kind of difficult to find and assemble in one place. And you talked about you were looking into in maybe creating some sort of standings.
Yeah, I did. I think I did that once. A research assistant and I, we did. My research assistant David, who is now a practicing lawyer in New York, he went through all the cases from the last century or something like that, and decided who won. And we compiled the standings. And if I remember right, Minnesota and maybe Wisconsin came out on top. Certainly Minnesota. Was this like something like 6-0 in their original jurisdiction contest? And somebody from the Minnesota Supreme Court wrote me an email saying that he was really appreciative of my work in this area.
That's pretty good.
Weirdly though, the national press did not pick up on that standing, those standings that I had kind of hoped they would.
Right. Well, we'll have to work on you'll have to do the update soon.
Yeah, well maybe I'll tweet about that a little tonight. Yeah.
In probably what's needed here is some champerty. You probably need to go around and convince more states to sue each other.
That would help, right? And then I could be the but if it became really big, then you know, then Lessig and, Sunstein, they'd all start writing about it, and I would get forgotten again.
Right.
It's a catch-22, you know, sort of, for me.
And I should add that there's 99 of these where the court has said, yes, we have jurisdiction and we're going to hear the case. And so Florida is asking for number 100. So this maybe we'll have the centennial case.
Great. And, maybe we should write this together.
Right. I think we'll have to get right on that. And then the book turns after a couple of chapters, it turns to the 21st Amendment. And the topic is federalism.
Right. Yeah, the 21st Amendment is the one that repealed prohibition. Prohibition being that failed experiment to not let people drink or manufacture alcohol anywhere. And what's interesting about the 21st Amendment, well, there are lots of things that are interesting about the 21st Amendment, but one is that there's this second clause in the amendment that people might not know too much about, and I'm trying to find the language here. It says that the transportation into any state for delivery or use of intoxicating liquors in violation of the laws thereof is hereby prohibited. And there's a question that's raised by this amendment about whether the provision actually authorizes the states to take actions that would otherwise be unconstitutional if they want to regulate liquor. And so it's an issue that nobody would really know about outside some really esoteric legal practices, but it's a pretty interesting one because it does sort of the 21st Amendment is after the First Amendment, it's after the 14th Amendment, and arguably by including this provision, the framers of the amendment sought to give states some extra power that they wouldn't otherwise have under the Constitution to deal with liquor. And there have been big cases. Cases have gone to the Supreme Court about that issue. And most recently, the Supreme Court said that no, that's not really what the 21st Amendment Section 2 meant. But it's a plausible argument and an interesting one to think about the relationship between federal government and the states.
And you have in that case you provide a behind the scenes. Now I'm assuming that this is not anything like how when you were clerking at 1 First Street that the actual discussions would go. Because first of all, it seems very much out of order.
Plus, Justice Rehnquist says, pineapple wine, yummy," which might not have happened.
But the import here, without giving away too much, is that they've just really gotten themselves stuck in this case, and everyone is voting in all sorts of strange coalitions.
Right. Yeah, it comes out very... so you're referring to a little play, really, that I wrote
right.
That's in the book. It's called The Justices Deliberate Granholm versus Held, which is the name of the case. And I just imagine what they might have been talking about at their conference. And I kind of infer what they might have talked about by what they wrote in the opinion, but I add jokes. And it is a weird case because they do line up in a really strange coalitions, which they very rarely ever have before or since, which sort of demonstrates the strangeness of the provision, I suppose. I can't be sure that this isn't exactly what they talked about during the conference because, of course, nobody's ever in the conference other than the justices themselves. So it very well could be that they talked about how delicious pineapple wine was. Let's start letting people in. I think that we're free to kind of speculate about what they talked about.
And the sort of real world issue that you focus on here is bottomless and or topless dancing. The courts really struggled with these dancing cases over the years.
Right. So one of the questions is whether a state or a local government or something can prohibit what otherwise would be First Amendment activities like nude dancing or nude stripping or whatever. If they can use their power, the states can use their power under the Section 2 of the 21st Amendment to regulate that activity, which would otherwise not be regulable, let's say, because the 21st Amendment postdates the First Amendment. And so the idea of the Constitution would be that the states have more power to regulate liquor dancing, new dancing in liquor establishments than they would new dancing elsewhere. And I think the court from time to time has said, yeah, but I think for the most part, they've said no.
And this raises an interesting issue because, two interesting issues is that the test for obscenity famously is something along the lines of "I know it when I see it."
So, that's what it used to be, but I don't think. It still sort of maybe boils down to that, but that's what it used to be back in the day before the new Miller versus California test gives it a little bit more shape. But yeah, that's what it was.
So how do they decide these cases where it's live performances and they can't see it?
You want me to say that they go there and watch, but of course they never leave the building, so they wouldn't be able to do that. See, what was great about the cases involving the movies is that they could just go down into the basement and watch the movie on the VCR or whatever at the court and decide whether it was obscene. But if you have to go out of the building to actually go to the place where the thing happens, the justices would never do that because they don't ever go try to actually see where these cases come from.
And there's the recent Behind the Case HBO documentary for the Ali case. And,
oh, right, the Ali case, yeah, uh-huh.
And it depicts some sort of session where the justices are previewing videos and cases because they're looking to grant certiorari in an obscenity case. So they have a lot of homework to do in the movie theater there.
That's excellent. They show the actual movie theater that the justices used?
Yeah, they show them watching it and discussing it. And some of them seem more and some of them seem less familiar with what they're watching.
That's great. But they were all men at this point, right?
Right, yeah. So it was. I wonder if the theater has been less used.
I couldn't find it when I was clerking. I looked for the theater and I wasn't able to locate it.
Well, do you think it has been disassembled?
It's either disassembled or it lies behind some sort of fake door that only the justices know about. Behind which there's some sort of there's a lounge, a plush velvet lounge. But I wasn't able to find it.
I mean, they've shown the computers that the Supreme Court justices have. I'm not sure that those can play videos.
Are they TRS-80s?
Right. Yeah. They seem a bit dated.
I'd like the TRS-80 color 4K color computer that I had when I was 12.
Right. Next, very interesting clause, and another one where it just seems like you're making these clauses famous is. Letters of
everything I touch turns to gold, really.
Right. Yes. It's alchemy. This is constitutional alchemy. Is the letters of marque and reprisal clause?
Uh huh. You think I made that famous? What happened? Something happen?
Well, the Captain Phillips movie has come out.
Oh, the Captain. Is it? Did they mention it in the Captain Phillips movie?
I'm stretching it here. I mean, they don't.
But you're right. Yeah, I see what you're saying.
They do have restrictions. I mean, it's very apparent they have restrictions. They don't have anything other than these water cannons. And I don't think that's because the Maersk couldn't, Alabama didn't have it in the budget, right? They clearly are avoiding having armament because they don't have their letters of marque and reprisal, right?
I see what you're saying. Uh-huh. Right. And you think it's called the letters of marque, huh? Not mark.
Oh, I might be saying it wrong. That's embarrassing.
No, I don't really know either. But I'm going to call him Mark.
I think that's what it is. I think I have it wrong.
I agree that we don't know for sure. In any event, the letters of marque and reprisal is the clause that gives Congress the power to give private ships the authority to fight pirates on the government's behalf, or to fight pirates, and then they have to bring back the booty, and it gets sorted out by the government. And after the Maersk Alabama incident, there was Ron Paul, just wanted to revive the letters of marque and reprisal clause to authorize boats to fight the Somali pirates and the new version of piracy on the east coast of Africa and whatever. And it didn't go anywhere. But it was discussed and it was noted in the newspapers and such. And so, it's a possibility for the future, right? If the government wants to use private boats to fight its battles, or we start losing money for the Navy, or we start not wanting to have as big of a standing navy as we used to, we can use this power that hasn't been used since like 1812 to authorize ships to fight for the government. It would be cool. Because everyone loves pirates.
And and you use this clause to discuss foreign affairs. And this is, I think, the chapter that's the closest to would have, could have, should have been a law review article. I mean, the way that you point out that the clause is used on both sides and in different ways in defining the president's other war powers.
Oh, right. Yeah. I guess it was so complex that I've forgotten it, the details of it. But I don't think I came up with any of that. I think people make that argument both ways about whether the existence of this clause says anything about what Congress can do in foreign affairs, and I just noticed it. I don't think that would count for a law review article unless I kind of pretended like I was filling an important gap in the academic literature, which I guess I could pretend.
I have to talk about the one on page 135 where, I mean, I think it's the funniest paragraph in the book, and I'm going to be giving something away here, but I just can't not, for the people who won't do what they should and go and read it, is you started to discuss whether or not the use of these letters of mark in reprisal would help deal with Somali pirates, and you start talking about how the experts in the field will tell you that the success of any given naval mission depends on the relationship of several key variables, including artillery power, flotilla size, mean rotation capacity of a flotilla, and median nautical distance to the command centers. And I'm literally sitting here thinking, oh, this is awesome. I need to look up all of these things, and writing down your formulas. And then all of a sudden you pull the rug out from under me.
Yeah, I don't know anything about naval science. I made it up to make it seem like it was really scientific, and
I mean, you had me fooled, and I think that someone should take a look at this. This mean rotation capacity of a flotilla.
Yeah, isn't that cool? I think I came up with that.
Right. I mean, are you sure that you haven't done any naval warfare? I mean, because I thought that made a lot of sense. You know, you have to turn around really quickly.
I'm worried that some people in the Navy might, use this paragraph without reading on and kind of try to calculate what to do with pirates and based on my formula, and then, of course, would end in disaster.
And I
should be a big warning on that page, maybe like a superimposed warning. Don't take anything in this page seriously, something like that.
In the age of the iPhone, I mean, there certainly are people who are reading this and are looking this up before they get to that next paragraph. I mean, there are people who are just stopping here and looking up mean rotation capacity of a flotilla, I'm sure.
That's right. And then they go off and they don't keep reading, and then they
lose their book on the side of the road. Yeah, I mean, it's...
I'm worried now. You've got me worried.
So the next clause is in the book. I mean, we've skipped a couple of them, but the title of nobility clauses.
Right. Well, that was the clause that started the whole thing. I was in, there was this one day at the Justice Department when President Clinton was going to Africa, and an African country wanted to give him some kind of, something, I can't remember even what they wanted to give him, something that could have been considered a title of nobility. And this is the kind of issue that would come to us. You know, somebody in the White House counsel would say, can Clinton accept this award or whatever? And there was one of my friends there, Ruby, was running around asking if anybody knew anything about the titles and nobility clauses. And I thought that was really cool. Nobody knew anything about the titles and nobility clauses, of course. But So I think it turned out that he could accept it, although I can't really remember for sure. But what these clauses say is basically that the United States can grant no titles of nobility, so they can't make anybody a duke or anything like that. And they also say, these clauses, that anybody who holds an office, in other words, anybody who's an executive officer, cannot accept a title, like king or prince or whatever, from a foreign government. And you know, the framers were just hated this idea that some people could be sort of stamped as better than everybody else, you know, coming from England and such. And so they thought this was a really important kind of equality principle to write into the Constitution.
And I was surprised to find that under the discussion of the nobility clause, that you have Article 1, Section 9, Article 1, Section 10, but I didn't see the Second Amendment anywhere.
The Second Amendment. What does that one say? I can't.
Well, Professor Peter Younger, the late Professor Peter Younger, argues that when that one says that in order that there be a well-regulated militia, the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
That rings a bell, that one, yeah.
So his interpretation is that the bearing arms there is not the sort of the metaphorical muskets, that it is the coats of arms, and that the meaning of the clause was that, and he calls this the original plain meaning, is that in order to have a well-regulated militia, you need officers, and to have officers, you need gentlemen and ladies. And they just didn't want to use the gender pronouns, so they wrote it in this confusing way. So it really means that the clause protects the right to be a lady or a gentleman and bear arms.
That's genius.
And he's even found a case, you know, in like the 1949 Court of Chivalry that discusses the right to bear arms. And it doesn't just discuss it or mention it. It's about it. It's like one movie theater is like suing a shop or the other way around because one is bearing an arms that the other one is supposed to have. And it relates that, though not frequently used, the Court of Chivalry is one of the original common law courts of England. It was like there on day one when William the Conqueror shows up, is because it's really important to have your, to be able to have you have your little drawing that no one else can have, because then you have your honor in your family.
Well, that's great. I knew nothing about that, but I love that. Awesome.
But
boss. That's totally boss.
it would be interesting to see an argument that maybe the Second Amendment partially repealed the title of nobility clause.
I think you got to write this up in your free time there at the law firm.
Well, I think writing about the Second Amendment is probably not something that is a good idea, right?
No.
We could refrain from that. That's people who know that they're going to be professors forever.
Oh, you can make partner on the basis of that article.
the next clause is actually one of my favorites because I'm really into, English Civil War history and Macaulay. And so, who writes the history of England, the Bill of Attainder clauses.
Oh, yeah. That does bring back memories of England, doesn't it? Although people in the United States, in the U.S. did it too. It's the idea that a law could impose punishment by itself, legislative punishment, legislatively imposed punishment, which is anathema to the separation of powers, because we want to have the legislature set what the law is, the executive decide if it's been violated, and the judiciary sort of adjudicate disputes about whether it's been violated. But a legislative punishment just basically says this guy's going to die for, you know, because he's a bad guy. So the Constitution prohibits it in one of its only kind of liberty-focused provisions before you get to the amendments.
And the other thing that there's you have to die, and then there's also the one that is we now own all of your stuff because you.
Oh yeah, right.
And there's this great argument by Macaulay that of course, because he's the one who's cited for the Eighth Amendment stuff, because the Supreme Court's really into, I think it was Titus Oates that was dragged around by his bowels, and so.
Ouch.
The Supreme Court cites to this all the time, and so I think he's the expert on the Bill of Attainder clause, and he says that the Bill of Attainder clause isn't as important as the one that prohibits you from attainting a person's property versus their life, because legislatures would just do that all the time.
Yeah, that's bad.
Like we're gonna take all. You know, it's hard to kill Walmart, but if they could just take the property of Walmart, they would
right.
Trump up some charges. So those are many, but not all of the clauses that you cover. And I guess the question is, what were the nearly odd clauses that you were considering but didn't end up putting in?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. I'm see if I can remember. I know I wanted to talk about the pardon power because I did a lot of work on that in the Office of Legal Counsel, and some really strange issues came up about it. And there's a paragraph in the final book about it. I decided it was not odd enough to include it. But there are some really interesting things about the pardon power. You know, the president has the power to pardon grant pardons for offenses against the United States, and pardons and reprieves. And some questions are come up about, like, can the president pardon himself? And is a pardon something that has to be delivered to a person and received before it can take effect, or can the president repeal the pardons? This came up a little bit in the Bush administration, right at the very beginning, when they were wondering, well, might it be possible to rescind Clinton's pardon of that billionaire financier, whatever that guy was. But so that was one. I can't remember the other ones. There were a couple others, but I can't remember what they were. Post-Rose is an interesting one. I have a colleague who's really into the post-Rose provision, but I never really seriously considered that one.
Is there, are there like notes somewhere where you talked about the direct tax clause by any chance, or was that?
No. Should I have done that? You know, there could be a whole other book.
Right, the odder clauses.
The not quite odd clauses.
Oh, the not quite, right? Because you don't want to. You wouldn't want to undercut the 10 you've selected here. You'd want to.
Well, yeah, you could. I guess it could be the oddest clauses. I don't know. There are all sorts of different ways you could go about it. You could write that. I mean, that would. If you wrote that book, that would help me sell my book.
Right. I think we should. Maybe there's a blog in this somewhere, but we'll have to see.
There was a blog, of course. You know.
Okay.
The odd clauses blog, which was. I ran that for a year, but then I got sick of it because I hate blogging.
but tweeting is a lot more fun, right?
Yeah, it is. Twitter is awesome.
Or one other question I had is, what were some of the other constitutional clause classification systems that you were thinking when you were selecting this book? Is when you chose odd and you defined it. And you explained why it was that you thought that was a good classification, but did you have like the most useless clause or?
No, I didn't. It's that day that my friend was running around trying to find out what the titles of nobility clause was. I thought of the title for the book that day. I thought I should write a book called The Odd Clauses. So I had been talking about that title and that classification for as long as I had the idea of the book. Now other people. were pushing me to classify things differently, like the stupidest clauses. You know, there was a whole academic symposium about the stupidest provisions of the Constitution. Useless would certainly be a possibility, but I never wavered from odd.
No. Now
can't do it all. You know, I'm just one person.
In that brings us to this Google Constitutional Database. Have you seen this project from Google?
No.
Google.
Once I wrote this book, I forgot all about odd clauses and constitutional things.
Put it in the drawer. Leave it. One writes to make a home for oneself in the mind of others, and then never visit. Is that the
beautiful?
Google has, I guess a few years ago, said, oh, we've got all these countries that are having these revolutions after the Arab Spring, and we ought to give them some help, right? So Google makes this website where they say, okay, here's all of the menu of constitutional clauses, right? And and that's the thing is, you know, how do you write a good constitution? But they either seem to be going for soundness or they just are really bad at completeness because – you know, when they have their, like, here's the subjects to cover, they definitely don't get all of the ones that you have here in this book.
So that means you got to, I think the foreign governments need to supplement their research. They need to look at the Google project, but they also need to buy the odd clauses and take a look at it, and should probably be translated into most of the world's languages.
Yeah, that, you know, and hopefully through the medium of podcasting, we can announce that if you are writing a constitution, that there is a book for you to.
And they could hire me as a consultant. you know, just to work on some of the sort of marginal parts of their constitution, not the main things, like freedom of religion or anything like that, but just sort of around the, you know, little things that people, other smarter people might not have thought of.
How awesome would that business card be?
Noah Feldman could write the main constitution, and I can just come in and I can sort of clean up around the edges.
And flavor. I can see, like, you know, you're the interior decorator and, like, showing them around. You've got, like, a suitcase that you open up.
Yeah, we could throw this in. I mean, this would go beautiful next to your, you know, free exercise clause if we had this little, the little accepting Sundays clause.
That's wonderful. But it would, you would have such a great business card, too. It would, you know, constitutional consultant.
That would be awesome. And there'd be a little ferret on the top, on the front of it.
Right, right. Yeah. So you're busy at work on your next book.
Yeah, I'm working on my. I've also written a novel, but that it's currently I'm chopping it around. But
is it Ed Tuttle, Associate Justice again, or is it different?
Yeah, no, it's about it's about Ed Tuttle, Associate Justice, and his days as a justice in one of the big terms of the modern era. But in terms of my nonfiction books, I'm working on a book called God Is Not Green, or God Is Not Always Green, when religious practice and when environmentalism and religious practice collide, something like that.
Working title.
Yeah, you know, the title will end up, like, the title ends up, the odd clause has stayed like this from the very beginning, but other titles, like my first book, Holy Hullabaloo, started off as Free Exercise, Expensive Gas, which I still really like, but the people at Beacon Press thought that nobody would have any idea what that meant. So, you know, you can't get too attached to a title. But the book, this book that I'm working on now is about instances around the world where you see religious practices harming the environment in some way, and what the societies try to do about it, what the legal system and otherwise try to do to reduce the pollution or other environmental harm from religious practices. And it's sort of like Holy Hullabaloos in the sense that it's a road trip book. So I've been going around the world to check out these cool things that are going on and writing about it.
Is there a lot more pre-screening of the topics from the publisher, or you know, are they?
No.
Not another weights and measures clause, you know.
No pre-screening. You know, I wrote in a proposal and said where I was thinking about going, and they were very happy about that, and so they're on board. And I have a lot left to write, but I've made most of my trips, I think. It should be done. My due date is the end of 2014, December 31st, 2014. And if that works out, it should be out sometime in 2015, towards the end.
Well, that'll be great. And maybe we'll have you back on, and really looking forward to that. As a final thought, do you have an update for us on the laugh track standings from the Supreme Court on how are the justices doing in getting laughs?
Yeah, well, I'm looking right here at the current standings, and Justice Scalia Scalia has 30, Breyer has 24. This is as of mid-January. Roberts has 12, Sotomayor has 8, Kennedy and Alito have 7, Kagan has 3, and Ginsburg and Thomas have 0. So at the top, it's pretty much the way it always is. Breyer was for a while challenging Scalia for top spot, but Scalia has kind of pulled away in the last week. Breyer could close things up this week, you know, if he works at it. I know he's working with Sarah Silverman on his technique, but I don't know if that's going to help. And then it's interesting that Sotomayor is in fourth place. She's gotten a lot of laughs. She's pretty funny. Her book is pretty funny, actually. I thought it was great. And what's really remarkable about this term is how terrible Elena Kagan's doing. I mean, everybody thought that she was going to come in and give Scalia a run for his money. Schumer said as much at her confirmation hearing. And by all accounts, she is a very funny person, but she only has 3 laughs, and it's a real disappointment, I think, for Kagan watchers everywhere.
Mm-hmm. And it's a little bit interesting to have the standings be as they are, and have you track this so faithfully, and to have the justice that you clerked for so consistently serious.
Yeah, she's no good with laughs. The last time I saw her was last year about this time, and this was right after Justice Thomas spoke for the first time in years and years and years, and not only did he speak, but he got a laughter notation in the transcripts, which is just unbelievable. He speaks once, he gets one laugh. It's like 1,000%. And so he had one and Ginsburg had zero, and I saw her and I said, you know, Justice Thomas just got a laugh. You gotta catch up with him. This is really bad. And she said, nobody knows what he said. And
yeah, I think I remember this. There was a controversy about what was the transcript, right?
Nobody knew what he said. And then they released a revised transcript with his joke, which was something about, a joke about Harvard Law School and how Harvard Law School graduates are maybe not great lawyers or something like that.
I think it was like something to the effect of just Harvard Law, meh.
Nah, blah, and then everybody laughed.
Which killed.
I mean, it's so exciting. It's so interesting. I mean, that was maybe the greatest day of my whole life.
that's pretty good. And there was another. Wasn't there more recent controversy over the laughter notations in the transcripts?
Oh yeah, there was Laughtergate, which was really quite incredible. The first day of arguments, the transcript had no laughters. I mean, they had no notations of laughter in it. And we were wondering, you know, those of us who care about this, and you know, Supreme Court laughter studies departments across the country, we're wondering what, you know, whether the reporter had decided to do away with these laughter notations, which would have been, you know, one of the worst things that could possibly have happened to me.
would have had to listen to the arguments.
Yeah, no, but I'm not interested in that. See, I'm not interested in actually how much actual laughter there is. I'm only interested in quote laughter. Not real laughter. And so there would be nothing to study for me. I mean, others are interested in the real laughter.
Have people attempted to submit corrections?
Oh, they often, on Twitter or whatever, ask me my methodology or suggest that, you know, maybe, I mean, there are other people who count these things too, and we don't have the same numbers. And so I'm asked about it, and I tell them that my methodology is to haphazardly and in a slipshod manner look through the transcripts and try to keep them out. That's my methodology. So it inevitably leads to incorrect results and unreliable data, but that's part of the project.
This reminds me of the green bag bobblehead certificate boilerplate language. That, you know, you're certifying your results not at all.
exactly.
Arbitrary and capriciously tabulating the laughter of the Supreme Court justices. This has been New Books in Law with Jay Wexler to discuss his book, The Odd Clauses. If you would like more on legal humor and especially knowing just how funny our justices are, you can follow him on @SCOTUSHumor. That's all the time we have for this episode. Stay iTuned for the next New Books in Law podcast. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter @CleeQuality for updates on upcoming episodes.